Welcome to Conversations with Achievers. I'm your host, Robert White. I'm a mentor to owners, executives, and their teams, and CEO of Extraordinary People, LLC. I work with people that want to create extraordinary business performance with less stress, more joy, and more personal fulfillment. So sit back, relax, and prepare to learn from your peers as we explore what it takes in terms of attitudes, habits, and behaviors that achieve extraordinary results. Results for yourself, for your family, and your community. Hello there, Robert White here, and welcome to Conversations with Achievers. This is where I have an opportunity to learn, and so do you, about the lives, the work, the learnings, the things to avoid, all of that, of some very successful people. And we have a very successful person with us today. And Meg, welcome to Conversations with Achievers.
Thanks, Robert. It's really good to be here.
It's great to be with you. And there's a ton of things that we could talk about. But how about just a quick introduction? How did you get to this grand CEO role that you're currently inhabiting?
I'll introduce myself. My name is Meg Gluth, and I'm coming to you today from Edmonds, Washington, which is the headquarters right outside of Seattle, of my business, which is called Catalent Solutions, Inc. Catalent, I'm the CEO and sole shareholder of Catalent. Catalent is a business that does chemical distribution and raw material sourcing, as well as contract manufacturing in those spaces. And so we have a sizable business headquartered, like I said, near Seattle, Washington. We have a plant in Chicago, Illinois, and sales offices throughout the country. I got here from a small town in Iowa. And so I think you and I probably share a lot of things in common and a lot of similarities, but I was born and raised in the Midwest and certainly think that it is one of the best places in the entire world to be from. And my journey spans from growing up below the poverty line in the Midwest and then eventually becoming an attorney in the Midwest and then eventually moving to the West Coast. And then ultimately coming to this company as initially its lawyer and then a bit of a journey to become its owner. So it's a great story and one that's still being written. But at my core, I am just fundamentally a very simple and pragmatic person who hails from the Midwest and enjoys immensely everything that I do.
Thank you. You know, that Midwestern background is really an interesting thing. The Buddhist, the Zen Buddhist have that expression that a fish does not describe water very well.
Yeah.
That whatever we're living in, we don't really see it.
Yep.
Where I really saw it is after living in Japan for a long time. Actually, I was still living in Japan. I bought a ranch in Northern California so that my son could ride horses. That's really the reason for that.
Yeah.
And if you think about California, I think for most people, and certainly for me, LA's the movie business. It's stars, it's surfacey people, and it is whatever it is. And then Northern California and San Francisco is the land of fruits and nuts. To a Midwesterner, it's slightly crazy.
Yeah.
And so that's the way I would think about California. And then I buy this ranch, which is in the foothills, this gold country. And it's like being in the Midwest. I felt like I had come home. It was not like California. And in visiting there a lot, our routine became I'd spend a couple of weeks there in June, bring my son there.
Yeah.
My former wife would go earlier always. And then I'd say a couple of weeks and I'd go back to work for the summer in Tokyo. And then in late August, I'd make the trip to pick him up. And in the meantime, we had these little rituals that my son and I did. And you get to talk to people, you know, that aren't on my ranch. My neighbors. And I asked them, why'd you come here? It was jobs. And there are all these factories, and the way they recruited was what was fascinating to me. They didn't run an ad. They didn't go on the internet. They went to their workforce and said, who else do you know in Iowa?
Yes.
Would like to come out here.
Yes.
Because you use that term practical, and that's what you want in a factory or in a sales job. You want people that are grounded to the earth.
That's right.
Not to the latest philosophy or something.
That's right.
And they had remarkably low turnover and things like that. And suddenly I realized that's who I am.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
This fish woke up a little bit to the water around it.
You mentioned a law background. I have a very dear friend who is a has a law degree from Yale. He was a big deal. He's never practiced law, and yet he says that being that training as a lawyer prepared him for an incredible amount of success. Is that true for you? Is that what you learned in the in law shows up for you most days?
Yes, but it wasn't just the legal education. It wasn't just the legal career. For me, even getting to become a law student was hard. It's very hard to go to school, to get into law school. I was fighting against some of what I would call my own demons and my own just lack of accountability, lack of drive. I got kicked out of college. That's a totally different story, but I just own it. I say the story, right? I got kicked out of college because I wasn't prioritizing my academics. And then I had to go back to college and prove to what ultimately the school I chose was the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. I had to prove to them that I was worthy of being in college. And then to get accepted into law school, and then I didn't have all of the financial bases covered there, and I needed help getting that handled. And so this whole concept of just constantly pursuing something, then you get to law school, and it's a very steep learning curve in a lot of different areas. The Socratic method of learning, being put on the spot. Nobody cares about your feelings. Nobody cares about whether that could be embarrassing for you. You're either prepared and know the answer, or you are not. And then we move on. It's the reduction of your own ego. It's the sort of reduction of your own pride. And then it's obviously a pretty arduous and strenuous academic path. I think everybody who's been to law school will tell you that. And then from there, I graduated from law school at the very beginning. Literally everybody had offers. We were all ready to start, and the financial crisis 2007, 2008 happened. So I graduated from law school in 2008. The economy was in a full-blown meltdown. And of the majority of my class of people graduating from law school, I was one of the very, very few that held on to a job offer. And I worked for a law firm that was a smaller firm, and they did a lot of advanced estate planning and privately held company advising for family offices and privately held companies. And so that's what I learned. That's how I learned to be a lawyer. I was a law clerk there for 3 years. 2.5 years prior to becoming a lawyer there. And I started right away, and I loved everything about that. But I will tell you that it's the whole process of learning that, of holding on to a job. I tell the story when I graduated and I kept this offer for my job from this law firm. They had just recently moved into a new office building. It's new construction, and there was no cleaning services yet set up. So one of the managing partners asked me to please take out the trash every day. And I was a lawyer, Robert. I had a law degree. I had passed the bar exam. But I was like, okay, because again, I'm a kid from Iowa. And if you ask me to take out the trash and you're 5 minutes older than me, I'm going to say, yes, ma'am, and I'm going to do it. You know what I mean? So this is what it is. And I'm taking out the trash every single day, every bathroom, every office, just walking around and doing the trash at the end of the day. And a year later, the same woman comes up to me at 5 o'clock or whatever. What are you doing? I said, I'm taking out the trash. And she said, why are you doing that? And I said, because a year ago you asked me to, and you never told me to stop. And I think that is also sort of part of the education. So when we talk about the value of the law degree or the value of the education, it's so many things that go in around that. And for me, it was certainly no different.
It sounds like that process, though, of that getting past the demons of childhood and then the struggle is what shows up for you today. You're not afraid of work. If you're like me, and I think you are, you're not afraid of hard work, and you're not afraid of struggling with something because that's something you've always done and learned how to do. There's
That's right.
definitely a how-to struggle. I don't know
For
if
sure.
anybody has anybody written that book.
I don't know. I think if we wrote that book in the Midwest, we would say, and this could be criticized in this day and age, we would say, if you struggle, don't talk about it. And there are some definite downsides to that. I don't mean to glamorize that, but I will say that there is a quality of everybody struggling. In the school I went to, for example, and maybe you feel the same, we were talking prior to getting on this podcast, you grew up in Wisconsin. Like everybody I went to school with, for the most part, was up early in the morning milking cows or doing some sort of hard manual labor, right? Taking care of farm work or whatever. nobody came to school and competed about who was suffering more in that work or who had it harder or whatnot. Like that whole culture of this is how bad it is to have to get up at 4 a.m. and milk cows, and my dad just came home with 20 more calves and all that. Like nobody did that. And there is a certain element of that, I think, now that you find referencing what you were talking about with hiring people in the Midwest, there's like a certain attitude of just do it, just do the work. It's not just doing the hard work, it's not stopping
You don't think
to
about it.
brood about it. Yeah,
Yeah.
it just becomes part of who you are.
Like you, I came from the wrong side of the tracks and poverty and abuse and all that stuff. And then over the years in the training business, you interact with thousands, hundreds of thousands of people. And there are people that had a lot rougher beginning than me, first of all. I got to meet them up close.
Yeah.
But what I learned is that those struggles, people make an interesting binary decision. And one decision is I'm going to avoid the issue. It's in there simmering inside me, and I'm going to get into alcohol or drugs or abuse of others or all of that. It's like there's one the path, and I'm simplifying this, but and then somebody else like me and others say, I'm not going to put up with this. In my case, I do a lot of work with organizations now on purpose. And what I realized in doing the work is that my initial purpose was I'll never be poor again.
Yeah. Yep.
I'll do the work so I don't have to be poor again. And I
Yep.
did have, and maybe you had this experience too, I got exposed to, there's a lot of money in Green Bay, Wisconsin. And it's just quite amazing. And in whatever your town in Iowa is, I'll bet it was true. And I got adopted by the town and by my friend's parents. So I got to see the 32-room cottage up on the Door County Peninsula, north of Green
Yep,
Bay,
yep.
and stay there for a week. And I got taken to Yellowstone, that wonderful trip
Yeah.
across America by another family. And all of those things showed me a different world, number one. And number two, it just really built on that belief that I had that I'll never be poor again.
Yeah.
And that turned out very well for me,
Yeah.
finally. But that we all have these different beginnings. The question is, I think, how awake are we to them,
Yes.
and do we use them in a leaning positive direction? You glossed over pretty quickly that move from lawyer to owner.
Yeah.
What
Yeah.
did you learn from that? How'd that happen?
Listen, so ultimately I made the move from the Midwest to the Pacific Northwest. Through and through, I love being outside, and I think there's no part of me that can exist without being outside. And Midwest is hard for that, particularly Minnesota. There's several months out of the year where you're just slammed indoors. And I had family out in the Pacific Northwest, and I always joke that if you're Norwegian, you either farm or fish. And I think that there's strong Scandinavian cultural presence out here too. So it felt a little bit at home when I would come visit them. I just loved it here. I love the fact that you could hike in January in the Pacific Northwest. So I made my decision to come out here. And when I was moving to Seattle, I have an aunt and uncle here. I had a place to live. I have the whole situation figured out, but I was interviewing at various law firms. And I wanted to understand sort of the culture of these firms. And so I reached out to a law school classmate of mine. And I said to him, "Do you know anybody practicing in the Seattle area where I could learn about some of these firms?" And he said, "I don't, but I know a guy there. He owns this like chemical business or something. You should talk to him because he's well connected and he might know who some of these firms are and what they're like." So I met with him. His name was Tony, is Tony. He's still a friend of mine and one of the most powerful mentors in my life. And he owned this company called TRI. Tony had been a West Point graduate and then a professional rugby player, and he founded this company from his living room in Seattle. And a true entrepreneurial spirit, answering the phone in the middle of the night, a global chemical and commodities trading business ultimately is what he was doing. And I met him and I just wanted to talk about law firms and things like that. But ultimately, he and I just hit it off on this business stuff. And I had advised small, closely held businesses before I had done that work. I felt really comfortable in that. And ultimately, he ended up offering me a job to be the company's general counsel. I said yes. But I will tell you, Robert, like I initially didn't know whether this company would need a lawyer. And so he asked what I wanted to make. I significantly undervalued myself. I didn't want to rip him off. Thought I'll probably work there for 6 months until I find something else. And I don't want him to pay for something that he's not going to use. And that's not how it went. I became the lawyer or the general counsel, and then I was the president and general counsel, and then I became the CEO of the company. Of course, this all happens over time. I'm a very quick learner. I'm a very ambitious entrepreneur. I understand things. I have a very pragmatic, sensible side, which is really good in business. And ultimately, what ended up happening is he was at a stage in his career, he's getting ready to retire, and I was getting ready to come up. And I said to him one day, if I could figure out how to finance this, would you sell me this business? And so he and I put together some really creative financing scenarios. And ultimately, our plan was this: I would buy 55% of the business, I would buy a majority, have control, take some of the load off of him from a just mind share sensibility. And then over time, I would acquire more and he would retire at some graduated pace. The ink gets dry on that 55%. I'm in more debt than I've ever been in my entire life. Numbers and zeros that have no, because I like you, it's just like, don't be broke. But to be here and to do this, it was like, holy smokes, like I couldn't even get it. And then just a couple months after the ink dries on that paperwork, we shut down the entire economy in the world for a pandemic.
Yay.
Yeah, so that was an interesting time in my life. And it was an interesting time in his too. He had been through financial crises, he'd been through currency crises, he'd been through everything, and he was just done. So a year later, I bought the rest of the business. And when I purchased the entirety of the business, I think we were doing about $45, $50 million a year in revenue, and right now we do about $100 million in revenue. I've done two acquisitions since that initial purchase. And I have diversified this business to various parts of global trade, as well as manufacturing and vertical integration. And so I'm having a ton of fun, but I'll be the first person to tell you, like, I shouldn't be sitting here. This isn't something I sat down when I was 13 years old and dreamed and visioned up, but I'm super happy to be here for sure.
When you made the switch from lawyer to CEO, by that time you knew a lot about the business from being in it. What did you find personally? What did you find most challenging, most difficult, and how you hold yourself and what you think other people thought of you and your effectiveness, all that, how did that affect you personally?
When you're a lawyer, when you're the general counsel of a business and you stand next to, as I was, you're standing next to the shareholders of the business and the leadership of the business, you hear everything. And it's your job to be wise counsel and to help influence decisions, or not influence so much as inform. This is on the one hand this, on the other hand this, the choice is yours. That shift from being a trusted advisor to being the person with whom the buck rests is a very interesting shift. And I say that all the time. You can't know what you don't know. In all of my time advising businesses and knowing the technical way that things should go, or knowing technically what a contract says, or all of that kind of stuff, there's nothing in the world that can prepare you for the day you're sitting there going, I know this is what my contract says, but we'd all be much better off if. Or I have 5 minutes to make a decision with very limited facts, and a lot of people's jobs are going to be affected by it, and I must make that decision, and I must stand by it, and I cannot afford to look weak. And I cannot afford to look indecisive. There's a lot of people in the room who can't stomach that. Those kinds of moments are something that you don't get until you're in the CEO spot. And I didn't appreciate that or recognize it until I was there. Further, that move from CEO to being the owner of a business is another leap like that. And I tell people all the time that the most surprising part, and the part you just can't know unless you've ever been there, is the loneliness of those spots.
It
It
is,
it's crushing.
in fact, only at the top.
Yep, it really is. It really is.
Did you have resources around you to help you with that? Did you have a coach, a mentor, a group that you joined? And what did you do to handle that personally?
I had all of the above, and in some cases, I had really good choices there, and in some cases, bad. Let me tell you why. When you are a young not naive, but trusting person from the Midwest, you don't necessarily have within you the muscle to know that sometimes people are coming to you to give you advice, which is self-interested for them. Okay. So I had a ton of people, and the newer you are at this, and sometimes if from the outside it looks like she doesn't know what she's going to be able to do, like you can sometimes get a bunch of people rush in to help that are not helpful. And I have to believe that's true even for people who've been around the block and have some experience. I think there's always that group of advisors waiting in the wing that are not, that are self-interested. But I had really good people in my life. I tell people all the time, I'm a recovering alcoholic. Some of the people in my life that were the best advisors to me during that time are people who used to sell drugs, people who are felons, but they had this sensibility and this ability to just look at life and say, hey, Meg, do the next right thing, do the next indicated thing. So I had advisors like that. I had a business coach, I still do. I had a therapist to help me continue to be a person who personally progresses. I have spiritual practices, and I have really good friends. But over time, I have refined all of those categories, and I've learned things that help me make sure that the people who are in those buckets are the right kind of people that I need. And that's something you can't learn until you're in the spot, I think.
That discernment, if you talk about that to the wrong group, they get very upset that you're really choosing the people around you. When my book came out, the book gets sent to radio stations and television stations and newspapers and the magazines, all those people. And then somebody reads it, usually not the interviewer, usually some poor assistant or secretary gets that job. And they come up with five questions. And one of the questions, quite often, is snarky. It's like their rule. They learned that in journalism school, or I don't know where they learned. And I had traveled, excuse me, I had traveled with the late John Denver for about 6 months, where we were interviewed every week. We were he'd do a concert one night, which he knew how to do, but the next night or the night before that, we would do this presentation on creating a sustainable future. And so to build the audience for that, we appeared on a lot of local TV and local radio, local newspapers, and so on. So I had an experience of watching him handle snarky questions. So then I go out and I'm promoting my book, and one of the snarky questions that occurred quite often was some form of, what's special about your book? There's a million books about personal growth. What makes yours different or special? And Meg, I'm not sure if I was tired. I was tired.
Yeah, I bet you were.
Different city every day. Or if I was just sick of these questions. I don't know what was going on for me. I think I have a little bit of cynicism in me that occasionally pops up. And they ask that question, what makes your book any better than all these other personal development books? And suddenly I heard myself say, remember, my purpose is to sell books. I heard myself say, oh, they asked the question was, isn't it derivative? Isn't it derivative? And my answer was, yeah, there are only two original books, the Holy Bible and Think and Grow Rich, and Napoleon Hill's book. And it's now 60 or 70 years old and still selling. And it's still a great book. But I suddenly realized it was like I could see the words going through the air. And I'm thinking, I just said that, and I'm here to sell b my book.
Oops.
But I would add, today I would add Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. But
100%.
there are different ways to express things. And it's all built on us personally. I'm really proud of two things in my life that are weird. I'm proud of being banned in China.
There we go.
Yeah, I got thrown out for being a radical, liberty-loving American.
There you go.
And some betrayal and stuff happened. But the other thing I'm proud of is I'm on the enemies list for Scientology.
There you go.
I'm very proud of that. And one of the reasons for that is that one of the things that's been part of our programs over the years is this formula for results, which is so simple and so profound, which is be plus do equals have. Whatever you want to have, there's these two things you have to pay attention to. What is it you do, certainly, and that's a very Western kind of
Yep.
thing and our Western way of looking at it. In the East, they pay more attention to your state of being,
Yes.
and as do I, and as we teach. And that formula of B plus do equals have is what got me banned because Scientology decided they owned that.
Oh.
and now it actually traces back to the Greeks around 300, 400 AD. But that idea that we need to work simultaneously on our skills, on what we do, our habits, our behaviors, while simultaneously pay attention to who we are.
That's
And
right.
it sounds like that's been a big part of your journey. And as the Aussies say, good on you, mate.
Yeah, thank you. I think it's an interesting thing because I agree with you, and I don't know. I think there's a certain amount of like life experience, maybe, that hammers in really the truth of that equation of both the being and the doing. And I think some have said that the first part of your life is for doing, and the second part of your life is for being. And I don't know that I necessarily agree with that. I am obviously very much in do mode. I run a company that's always growing, and I tell people I'm an object in motion. I'm constantly looking for the next thing, and I'm spinning at this rate because this is what I do, and that's just part of the core of who I am. But I also have a part-time job. I'm a yoga teacher, okay?
Oh.
And in that is my understanding that who I am, who my state of being is absolutely critical for maintenance and for reflection and for centered living so that all of the do can even be possible. And I think conversely, I can't be if I'm not also doing. Like they both prop one another up. My doing is a huge part of the expression of my dharma, if you want to use that language, or purpose, or whatever language a person wants to use. Those actions of doing are a huge part of who I am. But I think at the fundamental core, some of the most important times of my day, and I think this is where you're getting at too, which is the time I spend first thing in the morning, quiet meditation, perfect stillness, maybe not perfect stillness, but the constant redirection back towards that goal.
Yes.
Everything hinges off of that. Everything else
Well,
completely hinges off of that.
that growth from 40, 45 million to 100 million argues for the practice, frankly.
It
And
does.
in my work, my recommendation is always find a practice. And I don't care what it is. For some people, it's a walk with their dog. Other
Yep.
people, it's a swim. My dear friend Michael swims almost daily. To quiet, and he's a noisy guy, so that quiets
Yeah.
him down.
Yeah.
It's real hard to have a conversation in the pool while you're
Yes.
swimming laps. And other people, it's their faith. Recently, I've been doing an executive retreat called Living a Better Story, and someone else put it together. I'm the hired gun that comes in and leads
Yeah.
the 4 days. But those executives, it's very interesting how he has structured it and aimed it, and I love it. I feel like I've found my tribe, that kind
Yeah.
of feeling, in
Yep.
that. They are people that are Christians and Jews and Buddhists and Hindus and Muslims who run their life and their business based on their faith. However, and they're hugely successful people, and they blow me away. They don't go to church, they don't go to synagogue, they don't go to temple, they don't, they, and they're totally grounded in their faith. And I thought I was the only one, but the thing that I'm recommending, and my folks are recommending in our programs, is find a practice that quiets you so you can be with yourself more effectively and bring more peace to your life and your world. That 6 months of traveling with John Denver taught me that he signed a zillion autographs with peace, John Denver. That was his life. And I saw him. You're speaking of the snarky questions. The people would, at that time, there was a big thing about especially Christian fundamentalists of any religion were after the New Agers. So a lot of the snarky questions were like that. And we even had protest groups outside of TV stations and radio stations and all of that. And I watched him be so masterful at handling that question. And I've actually been using it myself recently. But and then he would go out to the limo and explode.
Yeah, because it's got to go somewhere. It's got to go somewhere. Yep.
But the paying attention to being, I think, is something that's quite often missing for even very successful people.
Yes.
It's something that I kind of look for and see if I can support them in doing it, and also to build on what they're already doing and
Right.
realize that they've accidentally wandered into something that actually really works for them, but they need to do more of it. And
That's right.
it needs to go in their schedule, that kind of thing. Look, I don't know, I'm doing this from the outside. I don't know anything about chemicals, and I don't know anything about commodity sales and all that stuff, and certainly
Yeah.
not manufacturing. But it seems to me that's not a particularly feminine role.
It's
And
not. Yep.
how does that work for you? Is that, I think it's getting better, just in the world in general, but how is that as a challenge for you?
I have to be honest, it's for me, I just never really go into any room expecting it to be a problem. And very often, if you're not looking for a problem, then you won't find it. And I don't say that to diminish some of the, frankly, crippling effects of having gender stereotyping and discrimination on the basis of gender in business. I'm going to be the first person to say right here and right now, we need more female CEOs of Fortune 500 companies. We need more women in leadership positions. And we could talk for a whole nother podcast about why that isn't there yet. But also, we have to be careful not to think that because someone isn't there, it's because they're not wanted there. And there's a very important distinction in our mind. Don't assume that because there aren't women in that room, it's because women aren't wanted in that room. And so I don't assume that when I go into most rooms. And I will tell you, Robert, most of the time, that's exactly the truth. I have run into situations, particularly in other parts of the world. The United States is, depending on who you talk to, but I will tell you, I'm a very proud American. I've been all over the world in business. I think this country is a privilege. I feel fortunate to be here, and I don't take any of this for granted. And we are very progressive in the way that we treat women and the way that we employ women here. And we still have work to do. Both things can be true at the same time.
Yep.
But I will say, I've been in places, particularly in other parts of the world, and sometimes here, where I run into situations. I'll walk into a room and somebody will ask when my boss is coming and things like that. And I laugh because I'm like, you're gonna be disappointed, but this is it. This is all you get today.
Is somebody still suggesting that you take out the trash?
No, but I would. See, that's the thing. Probably they just know that I would.
Maybe this is a good time to end our session. I want to suggest something to you, and that is that there is a lot of interest in women's leadership. And I've read enough about you and your work in your industry to bring more women into executive roles. And I want to suggest that we do this again and
That
just
would be
talk
great.
about women in leadership. I love this conversation. I
Thank you very
absolutely love
much.
it. If you're ever in Colorado, I want to buy you dinner and pump you for more knowledge.
Love that.
And if I'm in the Northwest, I do have dear friends in Seattle. I'll be in touch.
All right,
Thanks
you.
so
Thank
much.
you. Bye-bye.
Thanks so much for joining us for Conversations with Achievers. If you or someone you know would make a good guest for this weekly show, the details are at therobertwhite.com. And click on podcasts. I'm looking for businessmen and women with a story to tell, stories that might benefit other owners and executives. If you got some value from this program, I'd really appreciate you sharing about it on social media and just mentioned www.therobertwhite.com/podcasts. Of course, subscribing means you won't miss a show, and rating the podcast positively will leave Robert smiling. I'm building a movement here for leaders who want to succeed in business, succeed with their families, have fun, and contribute toward making the world a better place. It's special to me that you chose to listen. I look forward to connecting again next week. Remember, reach out to me anytime with any questions or concerns at therobertwhite.com. Bye for now.